/ We're Building Bridges. We'll visit with residents of East Palestine to talk about the train derailment and the decision to vent and burn 5 tankers containing cancer-causing vinyl chloride, which released more than 1 million pounds of toxins into the town's water, air, and soil. Resident Jamie Wallace and reporter Sam Mellon are going to reflect on 1 year after the toxic train derailment in East Palestine, USA, a full year since the Norfolk Southern freight train derailment, and the residents and workers are still struggling and left with many unanswered issues. And I have to say, the best way I can think of describing Jamie Wallace is, oh my goodness, she is a powerhouse. She is my idea of an organizer's organizer. And our dear reporter, Sam Mellon, who, notwithstanding being on strike for a year, which we'll find out a bit about, has been covering the issue. And I want to begin with you, Sam, who introduced me to Jamie, and just give us a kind of layout of the land of what brought you to the coverage of East Palestine a year later, and what your particular thoughts are in conjunction with the fact that, wow, it took a full year, but there was Biden with his photo op, not really meeting with the community or even local media. But you tell us the story that interested you, that brought you to East Palestine. And thank you both for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mimi. I came into this kind of late. You know, we've been on strike for 16th month on strike. Paper Guild of Pittsburgh, we're a local of the News Guild. It was a ULP strike. So we were on strike. At that point, we hadn't been on strike too long. When the derailment occurred, February 3rd, 2023, we had not been on strike that long. We were still wrestling with issues like making sure people had health care, making sure people had enough money to pay their bills, so they wouldn't go under, and those types of things. When the derailment occurred, you know, we had started publishing a strike newspaper, but, you know, we were still trying to figure out how to do this and to do everything else. And we wanted to get to East Palestine. We just could not get there. We just didn't have the bandwidth or the time. So I was about, I don't know, 3 weeks after. Jamie, you'll probably know better than me when this was. It was like the first town meeting that took place in a high school auditorium, and I just got in my car. It was in the evening, and I knew I had time to do it. And at that point, I felt like we had an obligation to be there. It's 30 miles from my house. I got in my car and I drove up there and sat up in the balcony at this town meeting. And it was one of the most disturbing and impactful meetings I've been at in a long, long time. People were very upset. They were very angry. The mayor and there was a representative there from the EPA. There were representatives there from the NTSB and from Norfolk Southern. People were very angry. They wanted answers to questions. They did not get those answers. Amy, I covered much of the Mon Valley, after the collapse of the steel mills here in Pittsburgh in the 1980s and early 90s. And I saw the same thing in East Palestine that I saw in those communities. I saw people who were under tremendous stress. Their lives were being buffeted around by forces they could not control and who would not answer to them in any way. I said, why is this happening in America? Why is this happening now? We saw this happen back 30 years ago, and yet it's happening here under different circumstances. The difference in East Palestine and what I saw in those earlier communities is that East Palestine had this flashpoint. You know, everything was normal in East Palestine up until 8:54 p.m. on Friday, February 3rd of last year. Everything was fine. People were like, it was a Friday night. It was 10 degrees outside. There was snow on the ground. People were just settling in for a Friday night. They're going to relax and enjoy the weekend. These are people who'd worked all week long. You know what it's like? It's Friday night. You're just going to chill out, see if people were watching Netflix or whatever. And then boom, all of a sudden, this train goes barreling through town. It's doing 47 miles an hour. It flies off the tracks. And, 38 cars fly off the track. They are 11 of those. I think 11 of those cars, Jamie, you can correct me if I'm wrong. 11 of those cars have toxic substances in them. Those cars burn. They kept these toxic substances, including vinyl chloride, which is a known carcinogen, catches fire. This is a massive fire that extends several hundred feet in this small town. The flames are at least 100 feet high, and people get out, you know, they hear the fire trucks, they get outside, they look, and they see this massive fire on the edge of town. And within minutes, they have policemen knocking on their doors saying, you have to leave now. So you have this moment of like near panic in the city, people are trying to figure out what's going on. They don't get any answers. They're just told, get out, take what you can and get out. They're trying to get their pets together, trying to get what they need together. They don't know where to go. And they scatter. So, and then 3 days later, of course, I mean, a lot of you folks probably remember that the toxic burnout that occurred 3 days later, where some brilliant mind decided to burn off these toxic chemicals 3 days afterwards. And we had that gigantic, massive, horrific looking black cloud that hung over. There happened to be an inversion that day. So that cloud went up 3,000 feet and stopped and held all those toxic substances right over that town. So you have people who are dealing with like the trauma of that evening, and then the as well as the toxic, the questions about toxic exposure, that they don't feel they're getting good answers for that. Mm. That's what drew me to this, Jamie. I felt I had an obligation as a journalist to go cover it. Mm-hmm. I'm on, you know, we're on strike. You know, people there were telling me I feel abandoned. You know, we kind of feel the same way. The difference is I'm not exposed to toxic substances every day. Jamie is. Jamie has that experience of trauma, of that moment where, you know, you go outside and you look and you think, oh, my God, my whole town is burning down and I've got to get out of here now. Mm-hmm. You know, that mm-hmm. has a deep impact on people.
Well, Jamie, I think he gave you the perfect intro, though. I have to say the one... two words, really, or two or three words that you said to me over the phone when we spoke during the weekend just, you know, are drilled into my head. And I'll tell you what they were. You were talking about children both coughing up blood and blood was coming mm-hmm. out of their ears. You are my Aaron Brockovich, who took on the nuclear industry and the contamination. But you tell us your story and pick up from where... you were just guided to, both by myself and certainly our valiant striking reporter, Steve Mellon.
Well, thank you for having me today. You know, I've had people say that about Aaron Brockovich, but I'm telling you, I'm not Aaron Brockovich. I'm just a mom who refused to let her kid go back into a house that I knew wasn't safe. You know, the night of the derailment, one of the things that was really frustrating is that a lot of people weren't notified. They had cops going door to door, but they never sent out any kind of alert, an emergency system, nothing of that nature. It was total chaos. Most of us learned that we needed to be evacuated by word of mouth. I learned because my mom called me. So that night, being in a rural area, there aren't a lot of hotels. People didn't know where to go. People that had pets, you know, try finding a hotel when you have four dogs or... So there was just all these issues and chaos. And I ended up staying with my brother. He had gotten a hotel room and we weren't so lucky to find one in the area. And we just kind of thought it was for the night. So he said, you know, come over and you can crash in our hotel room or whatnot. You know, the next day we realized we weren't going back home. We found a hotel in West Virginia. And I told my husband, it was Sunday now. The derailment was on Friday. I told him that I was going to go home and get our prescriptions because, you know, that's something that we didn't think about grabbing was prescriptions. I was going home to get the prescriptions and we started arguing and he said, what are we going to do when they lift the evacuation? And I said, we're going to go home. If the EPA says it's fine, then it's fine. And he said, no, like, we're not going home. I don't care if we have to sleep on the riverbank. As soon as I pulled in my driveway at home, I knew that he was right and I wasn't. I knew the EPA was lying to us. I pulled in my driveway immediately. I can't breathe. I'm coughing. My eyes are watering. You know, I look over and I see chemicals free flowing down the creek. And it's kind of the same thing I keep saying now is, when does the EPA listen to the people? Like, I don't care what their science was telling them. I don't have to be an educated person. I don't need to have a science degree. My body told me all that I needed to know. Now it's been a year of us screaming, like, we're having these symptoms. We need help. We need to get out. Almost immediately after they lifted the evacuation, people started reporting illness. We later learned from the EPA, the only testing that they were doing on our homes was this indoor air testing to show you it was safe. They would go into your home and walk around with this handheld monitor that we now have learned does not even measure some of the chemicals and other chemicals. It was only measuring at emergency levels, which meant that it was safe to be in for a few hours, not to move back into. Long story short, I threw a fit when they were doing this air testing. They said everything was fine. I kept questioning them about the creek water. They went into my basement. They saw some creek water that ran down the basement wall, and they said my house was contaminated. That was on February 14th. On February 15th, the next morning, and also they that said my house was contaminated was CTEH. It is actually the company hired by the railroad to do testing, which I never in a million years, when they said they would send them, I thought, oh, you know what they're going to say. But, you know, the guy said it was contaminated. The next morning, Norfolk Southern called and, well, we'll pay up some of your rent and we'll get all your moving expenses. And, you know, tell us what you want. Give us a number. I was like, let me get back to you. Like, I'm not sure what my life is worth. So anyways, I decided that instead of just taking the money and leaving, like, I was going to let people know. You know, they weren't just wrong about my house and I happen to be the one big mouth in town. They had to be wrong about other houses. And I have 47 immediate family members that live in that 1 mile zone. You know, I have every person I ever loved or cared about was right there in that town. There is no way that I could ever live with myself if I would have left and left some other kid in the same situation my daughter could have been in. That first town hall was February 15th. And I know that date because it was my birthday. I was walking into the meeting and I saw the mayor and I said, did you know my house was deemed contaminated today? And he said, no. The other notable thing about that first town hall is Norfolk Southern was supposed to be there. They pulled out last minute and said that they didn't feel safe to come to the meeting. So you have the EPA, oh my gosh, have politicians, you know, the mayor, the fire chief, everyone standing up there saying no contamination is found in a home. Well, again, because they weren't testing for the right limits, but, you know, the mayor knew what I was going to say and he was kind of avoiding me the whole time. And my husband finally got tired of it and he just kind of like snatched the mic out of the mayor's hand and he said, it's my wife's birthday and she's been waiting long enough. You know, so I told that whole auditorium what was going on and not one single person called me back. Not one single state or federal representative called me back. No one cared.
Well, Jamie, let me ask you this. What are some of the symptoms that people in the last year have been experiencing? And then I want you to talk about this coalition that you've put together as you are by and large either lied to, the efforts to manipulate by local politicians, certainly the company with the chemicals, Norfolk. None of them, and nor has the, and we'll talk about that, the federal government come in where they should. So you've got Norfolk Southern's toxic train derailment, and they're really doing nothing. Tell us about the actual conditions and the coalition that you've now put together and what its demands are for the people of East Palestine.
You know, so right away when people were told it was safe to go home, you know, we found out later that Norfolk Southern just covered up all this contamination with their railroad tracks to get the trains back running. They couldn't run through an evacuated community.
And that was so dioxin. We were definitely let back in. Was that dioxin in the soil? Is that part of? I know there was initially a burn off of vinyl chloride, but was it the dioxin that they actually covered up with the train tracks to correct the derailment?
Well, what they did is they dug burn pits and then they kind of blew holes in the side of these tankers and drained all those chemicals into the ditches and then set the ditches on fire. Not all the chemicals burnt and they just covered it up and rolled out. NTSB hearings, actually OxyVinyl, the owner of the vinyl chloride, told Norfolk Southern that there was no reason to blow up those train cars, that the one car that they were in fear of, that there was no way it was going to polymerize. That word is so hard for me. And that the tanker actually, they knew the tanker had cooled down and was leveling out, but that information never got from Norfolk Southern to the decision makers. So I think that's important, because even if you buy into it was an accident that it derailed, it was no accident that they withheld that information to blow up that tanker. It was no accident that they knew they drained all those chemicals in there and covered it up with gravel and rolled out so that they could get those trains back up and running. Those trains were waiting in a nearby community to come through town. Most of those trains, they were running back through town before residents were home. So that's, you know, the important little background piece of it. But the dioxins were created during the burn. You know, when you burn these chemicals, and we found this out too, they were only testing for the chemicals that were literally on the train. But when you burn the chemicals, they create other chemicals. One of the byproducts of vinyl chloride is formaldehyde. You know, they weren't testing for formaldehyde. They told us there was no reason to test for dioxin once they lifted the evacuation. But we just recently discovered documents that show that actually the railroad and EPA were doing dioxin testing back on February 9th, and they knew we had elevated levels of dioxin. But they just let us come back in.
So let's get to the point now of the coalition that you have formed and the demands. And then I want to get back to our intrepid reporter and allow him to kind of punctuate the situation. And obviously, we're going to have you back, Steve, to talk about the strike, which has gone on a whole year now and counting. And hey, you are a fellow journalist, so we've got to get to the bottom of that. So, Jamie, the nature of the coalition and the demands, and who is being who are the demands being tapped on the door to? Is that the federal government? Is it the federal government and Norfolk? Who are the targets that we need to get on board to support you about?
I created the Unity Council. I actually modeled it the same way that I had modeled my union at Cleveland State University. I had worked there for 15 years. I was the president of SEIU 1199 for 8 of those years. I didn't realize that was organizing. I don't know. They said, you know, someone said, you have organizing experience. How'd you organize like this? And I'm like, no, I modeled it after my union. And they're like, oh, stupid. That is organizing. So what I realized right away is this was not just a community that was dealing with contaminated water or just dealing with the contamination in the air. You know, we had contamination of air, soil, water. We had indoor air contamination, contamination on our surfaces. We needed people to just watch the EPA. We needed people to watch Norfolk Southern. We needed people to work with these independent scientists. I tried to do it all and burn out really quick. So I was like, I need some help. So I started Unity Council for the East Palestine train derailment. What we did is divide it into executive committees. So we have a committee that focuses on like the political part of this fight, one that focuses on human health, things of, you know, each person, I guess, they have their own interest, I guess, or their own specialty, the thing that they're good at. So we've kind of, you know, did Unity Council in that manner to make sure, you know, people were fighting for what they wanted to fight for and what they were good at. And trust me, there's plenty of us all to fight. So we did come up with a list of demands. You know, because we sat down and we were like, well, you know, what is it that we really want? Like, what can we hope to get from this? And, you know, right now this is focused all at the federal government. There's no sense in focusing it to our local government. We won't even get into how they're being bought off. But our state government, we actually got no response from. We disrupted at the state house. The next day we got DeWine to sign for the declaration of a disaster That was the first step.
And DeWine's
was for him
with
to
federal
ask for one.
EPA, right?
The second step is to get President Biden to actually do the declaration. So, you know, the first thing we definitely need is for everyone to urge the president to sign this disaster declaration. Like, we've been waiting for over a year now. Our kids are soaking in these chemicals. They bioaccumulate in your system. There is absolutely no research on what multiple chemical exposure does to you. When they come up with these reportable limits, a subject is only subjected to one chemical at a time. But there's no studies that say, what if you're exposed to 25 different chemicals all at once at below that reportable limit? That's what we're dealing with, is they really don't know. So we need that healthcare. And we need healthcare that covers seeing toxicologists, that covers getting these chemical testing. This is stuff that is not covered under insurance.
And I want to make sure that we just need to spend more time on the story, and we'll continue to follow it up. We have to understand, to ensure, and I know that's a fundamental demand, to ensure that the environment, the animals, the people affected by the train derailment and subsequent explosions of these dangerous carcinogens are restored and made whole, and we have to find out more about what that is. But in the last minutes, I want you to be able to tie this together, Steve. You've got, it seems to me, the story of East Palestine and this horrific disaster for a community and its efforts, another part of the story, to be made whole, and then the issue of the federal government. But tie it together for us. You're the reporter on this. That's part of our story as well.
Well, one thing I'm learning, you know, as I watch this thing unfold, is the power of grassroots organizing. And I listen to Jamie and I hear that. I see it when I go down there. This is a movement that it's organized. They've got their act together. They're very vocal. They're pushing all the right buttons. I understand the frustration in not making things happen. I mean, we've run into the same thing here. I just feel like no matter what you do, you're ignored. The media moves on. The politicians come in for their photo ops and they move on. You know, one of the most moving moments of this whole saga in the last year or so happened on Friday. President Biden came to town. You know, there was a lot of mystery surrounding where he was going to be and what he was going to do. There was some hope that he would address his residents. And I was standing along Taggart Street, which is the street that runs parallel to the tracks. It's the closest street to the tracks where the derailment took place. And a number of residents were out there. And these are people I've gotten to know over the past year. Jamie was there. Chrissy, Krista, Ashley, all these people, Jamie, that you know, and most of these people, I think all of those people we just mentioned, have not yet returned to their homes. These are people who still feel their homes are unsafe. The clock is ticking here. Norfolk Southern has told them that they're no longer going to support them financially. These are people who, you know, these are working class families, working class people. They do not have resources to stay out. What I saw there was a community of people that came together, grassroots. This is not hierarchical. These are people binding together, people stepping up into leadership roles to defend each other, to stand up for each other. And there was this moment when Biden's entourage went by and Jamie and everybody else held up their signs, and their signs said things like, please help us, save our children. They called out, and Jamie started this, please help us, save our children. I watched, it was heartbreaking to watch the president's caravan go by. And I just saw every one of these people break down into tears afterwards. And, you know, this was a lost opportunity. It was a lost opportunity, I think, for our federal government to step up and say, we see you, we recognize you, we care about you. We're not just going to stop in here and pretend like we're going to do something. We're actually going to listen to you. It broke my heart that didn't happen. I know it broke other people's hearts. The one thing that I find uplifting about this is that I see people coming together. They don't care about politics. They don't care about religion. They care about each other. That, to me, is a beautiful thing. It's happening in horrific circumstances.
Steve Mellon, I'm afraid that we're out of time. We've got to continue on this story. And of course we will. We will not just visit East Palestine once every year for a photo op. And I want to thank Steve Mellon for introducing us to Jamie Wallace, to the story, the way he put it together. We'll find out more about the year-long strike of our fellow journalists and what we can do to support them, lest it be another year and we lose an invaluable, important news outlet for local news. And Jamie Wallace, yeah, you're spectacular. You don't have to be an Aaron Brockovich. You're my Shiro. Organizing and organizing around the necessaries of life for family and community, and that makes you absolutely my Shiro. So I want to thank you both, and we'll continue to follow through with this story and learn a lot more about how we are going to weigh in to work with our siblings in East Palestine for the whole solution and find out exactly who we're going to get it from and how. Jamie Wallace, Steve Mellon, thanks for the work you do. Sorry that you have to be doing it. Not you, Steve, covering the issues, but you, Jamie, most certainly experiencing this. But you are educating, agitating, and organizing most of us to think much more about environmental disaster and what our government and corporatocracy owes the people for a healthy and safe environment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mamie.
Thank you.
And this has been Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and Ken Nash will be back next week.